Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Fires of Hell by William Johnstone and J.A. Johnstone. Narrated by Danny Campbell. Prologue. To the editor of the Immigrant City Weekly, Clarion and Light. Dear Sir, a copy of your newspaper from the 23rd Institute came into my possession after it had been discarded on a stagecoach in Purgatory City and shown to me for amusement. At least, I am merely guessing that was the fool's reason for bringing that rag, wadded up and stained from the mud wagon's floor and dust from its travels from your city far to the north and east. I was not amused, as the lad learned when he left with, as I read in another one of your articles in the edition of the 23rd Institute, his tail tucked between his legs. While I did enjoy looking at your advertisements for cigar manufacturers and the piano salesman and Mr. Bowman's fine art gallery and photography and the bookstore owned by Madame Woodlawn and the houses for sale and your very own architect and builder of the new steam sawmill and all those attorneys, the lots for sale, the dental surgeon, and gosh, Oswego cornstarch for puddings, Blanc Mange ice cream, etc., and so many tonic pills and clothiers and treatments for epilepsy or fits, cook stoves, and the next meeting of the Agricultural and Mechanical Association. Alas, I won't be able to attend the next fine session. And your timetables for your river boats and railways. So many luxuries that we just don't seem to get out here, far removed from civilization, that you most certainly have in Immigrant City. What I did not enjoy, sir, was that article on page 4, your last page. If you don't recall the article, it is the one butted up against the ad for the Fulton and Schneider General Store, announcing the staple and fancy dry goods, silks, hosiery, notions, dress trimmings, ribbons, kid gloves, ties, parasols, fans, hair braids, corsets, French and American, bleached domestics, gents' furnishings, carpets, wallpaper, straw, fur, and woolen hats, hardware and crockery, and showing goods to you is never a problem. We had a store almost like that here in Purgatory City till Sean Keegan tore down half of it in a brawl last week, although I don't think Mr. Pendergrass stocked corsets, French or American. The headline of the article was, Fourth Jackal in Purgatory City, Fine Traders Butchered by West Texas Renegades, A Cry for Law and Order, Texas Rangers at Wit's End, Barbarous butchers call honest traitors renegades. But the true renegades are revealed, and they are the jackals. Once three, now four. Justice demanded. My, oh my. That sure looks like a lot of headline for a story that is but 6 paragraphs long. Please pardon my ignorance about English and spelling and such, being an uneducated rube from the far frontier, and not of your civilized city of railroads, riverboats, and universities, whilst you proudly point out being a newspaper editor for more than 29 years. But should not fourth, F-O-R-T-H, be fourth, F-O-U-R-T-H? Let me point out some glaring factual errors in this article you deemed worthy of publication. In the first paragraph, you identify Purgatory City's resident jackals being led by Captain Mike McCulloch, a former Texas Ranger. Well, Matthew McCulloch is indeed a former Texas Ranger, driven out of that valiant organization by politics, not justice, but he never served as a captain. You call him a notorious horse thief. He catches wild mustangs, sir. Usually he's only stealing them from the herd of wild mustangs. Horse thieves, as you have rightfully pointed out, are among the lowest dregs of humanity, and they are often summarily executed. Very true. Out here, where a person's life might very well depend on his horse, we West Texans tend to regard horses as our best friends when the chips are down. So when a man steals a horse, he puts the horse's owner's life at risk. And I have seen at least one man who was hanging from a telegraph pole for stealing a horse. However, Matthew McCulloch, as far as I know, and I know him pretty well, has never once hanged a horse thief. Granted, he has beaten one or two to a pulp, and he said he shot Grover Blue in the thigh when that rapscallion tried to steal a fine stallion with some thoroughbred running in its blood. But McCulloch knows the laws of Texas, and stealing a horse has never, ever been a capital offense. Likewise, in your narrative, you missed your aim in your description of Sean Keegan, who I have previously mentioned in this letter. But at least you spelled his name right. However, Sean Keegan, who, like many a good Irishman and many a Yankee soldier, does enjoy a go at fisticuffs every now and then, quite possibly he's brawling somewhere as I write these words, and quite probably he's knocking a tooth loose while you read my letter. But you call him a former army captain. Why, sir, such a libel as that would send Sean Keegan riding hell-bent for leather from here to Immigrant City to challenge you to a fight for the sake of his County Cork honor. Sean Keegan would never have accepted an officer's commission. During his valiant service in the post-war army, he was a sergeant, many times a sergeant, when he wasn't being stripped of a stripe and bumped down to corporal or rank trooper for defending his Irish honor, or, more than likely, having one or 20 too many rounds of his beloved Irish whiskey. And lastly, there is your description of Jeb Breen. Jed with a D, not Jeb with a B. And Breen without an E at the end. You call Jed a bounty killer. The proper term, sir, is bounty hunter. Yes, Jed Breen has killed, but only when his life or someone else's life was at risk. While he has the reputation of bringing more men in dead than alive, if you took time to check with Texas Rangers, U.S. Marshals, judges, jailers, attorneys at law, and county sheriffs, you will learn that most of the men Jed brings to justice are turned in standing, breathing, maybe bruised, but certainly alive, at least long enough to hang by the neck till they are dead, dead, dead. You also described Mr. Breen as the silver-haired fox. His hair is pure white, sir, not silver. White as a summer cloud. White as a handkerchief freshly laundered. Now, about those traders you referred to as honest, law-abiding merchants, I suppose they are traders, although I don't think the law allows for what they have been trading. Recently, hundreds of thousands of Americans died to end the barbaric, yes, I say this as a Texan, practice of slavery. Traders might be one way to describe them. White slavers is another, although that is not entirely accurate either. For these so-called traders you describe as fine and honest dealt Indians from Mexico and New Mexico territory, and Mexicans from south of the Rio Grande, and even some from the fine state of Texas, and yes, whites too. White, Indian, and Mexican women and children, especially young boys who could be sold to work as slaves in the mines down in Mexico. Fine and honest, Mr. Editor, are not adjectives I would ever use to describe a Comanchero. They aren't even human beings. They are instead the barbarous butchers and true renegades, and they are the foul, evil vermin who have the Texas Rangers and U.S. Army and sheriffs and citizens of the westernmost reaches of our state at our wits' end. They sell guns and liquor and ammunition and women and children to the last Comanche holdouts, hence their name, Comancheros. And lately, the Apaches who come up from the south of the border or from New Mexico and or Arizona territories, even Cheyenne and Kiowas, Comancheros are dung. They should be wiped off the face of the earth. Honest traitors? Ask your wife, your daughter, your mistress, your mother, your grandmother, if they would rather do business with the common Chero or your glorious and wonderful Fulton and Schneider General Store. The candle is about to burn out, and my fingers are cramping from holding this pencil for so long, so I must close this letter, but not before I point out your final error. That regards to the fourth jackal. If killing a dozen traitors, that is, common Cheros, makes me a jackal, I will gladly take that honor. In fact, when such a title was first handed to me, I felt pride almost boiling over. Sir, in West Texas, human beings, red, white, black, brown, kill other human beings, red, white, black, brown, to stay alive, to protect their loved ones, to survive another day when lightning, rain, smallpox, or some other disease, not to mention childbirth, or a horse's hoof, or a horse's stumble can kill you just as dead as a gunman's bullet or a Comanche arrow. But, sir, I must protest your libelous claim that the fourth, F-O-U-R-T-H, or fourth, F-O-R-T-H, jackal, killed a dozen honest traitors. They were certainly not honest. I doubt if they ever heard the word. But only a dozen? Why, you low-down lying fool, I am sure I cut down at least 30, but no more than 45 of those wretched evil men. And I hope to double that if ever I run into more common Cheros. Unsigned, a Perdition County citizen. P.S. Pardon my West Texas ignorance again, but what exactly is blancmange? Chapter 1. The bullet whined off the rock the moment John Keegan looked up. Gravel and dust kicked into his eyes and sent him sliding back behind the big chunk of granite for cover. Cover? The chunk of lead that had briefly blinded Keegan whined past Keegan's right ear, slammed into the canyon wall a few feet behind him, and zinged back, the lead now cut in half. One chunk struck the rock about an inch or two from Keegan's right arm, the one holding his Springfield carbine. The other spit up sand in front of Keegan and thumped harmlessly against the former cavalry trooper's left boot. "Confound it, Jed!" Keegan shouted to his partner. "I like to have just been crippled on account of you." Another gunshot rang out from the dugout down the hill. That bullet hit the canyon wall and zinged off into oblivion. Sean Keegan cursed again. Cursed while cringing like a yellow-bellied coward or some greenhorn trooper. A soldier might eventually get used to the sound of gunfire, but the noise of a ricocheting bullet put the fear of the Almighty into even the most hardened veteran. "Stick your head over that stone again, Sean." Keegan turned to give his meanest look at Jed Breen, but that was just a waste of effort. The white-haired bounty hunter wasn't even looking in Keegan's direction. He crouched about 20 feet off to Keegan's right, the barrel of his heavy Sharps rifle propped up in the V of his shooting sticks, the stock braced against his right shoulder, and Breen's right eye staring through the long brass telescopic sight affixed to the barrel of the 50-caliber cannon. "I mean it," Breen said. His head never moved from the Sharps. Had he not spoken, Keegan could not have determined if his old partner in this affair were still living. A man couldn't even tell if Jed Breen was breathing. He resembled some old juniper, dead but standing till Judgment Day. "I didn't join up with you to get my head shot off," Keegan said. "That's a Winchester," Breen said, still not looking away from the brass scope. "Not even a .44 caliber. Must be a .38-40. We're 130-40, no more than 150 yards away, and he's shooting uphill. Not very much chance that he'll shoot your head off, thick as your skull is." Keegan felt his blood rushing again, the way it was prone to do when he found himself working alongside Jed Breen. That blood pressure might blow off his head. "He still might kill me," Keegan said. "Didn't say he wouldn't kill you," Breen said, still focusing on the dugout. "What I said was he wouldn't shoot your head off." After choking down the curse, Keegan gathered his rifle and crossed his legs to see if that bullet fragment had done any damage to his boot. He could just make out a dent in the heel, but he had seen rougher damage done by mesquite and stones, so he twisted around, wiped his palms on his shirt front, and decided to look around the left corner of his boulder. Wetting his lips, he brought the Springfield's barrel over, bracing it against a natural groove in the side of the granite, and aimed at the dugout. He saw the flash below, the white smoke, heard the report of the Winchester, and felt the heat as the bullet screamed past his ear. That slug tore through a heart-shaped prickly pear and whined off another rock. No, not quite a whine, just a ping. But Keegan had pulled himself back, shaking his head, feeling the blood roaring like an express train, and tried to catch his breath.
"That must be Billy Ray," Breen said. "Darn good shot, Billy Ray. Much better than his brother, with a rifle anyway. Six-shooter, too. I don't think Jim Bob was ever good at anything, except with a running iron on other men's cattle."
"You told me that rustlers usually don't put up much of a fight," Keegan yelled.
"They aren't just rustlers anymore. They are escaped convicts."
Keegan's mouth tasted like sand. He wanted to spit, but his tongue was drier than this patch of misery.
"You could at least take a shot at those outlaws," he growled, "so they wouldn't keep taking pot shots at me."
Suddenly Keegan got mad. He crouched, brought the Springfield to his shoulder, pulled back the hammer, and quickly spun around, fired, and ducked back behind the rock. The carbine's report drowned out any satisfaction he might have gotten by hearing the bullet strike anything, man, dugout, tree, cactus, boulder, or even one of the two horses in the corral about 20 yards east of the dugout. A moment later he heard laughter from below, then a Texas drawl.
"That the best you can do, pardner?"
"No, don't have a shot."
Breen was as calm as a night sky, and it took a moment before Keegan realized the bounty hunter was addressing Sean Keegan.
"Dugout's walls must be 3 feet thick, probably with some stone in there. Only one opening, the door, and whoever's shooting is too far back for me to hit him. So I figure let him waste his lead. I know what they say about a repeating rifle, that you can load it on Monday and shoot till Sunday. But that's not true, and 38-40 cartridges are hard to find in this country."
5 days earlier, Jed Breen had found Keegan outside a grog shop in Purgatory City. Keegan had known the bounty hunter mostly by sight and reputation until a few years ago, when fate had brought the two together in a stagecoach station with Matt McCulloch, a horseman who had been kicked out of the Texas Rangers. Keegan had just been kicked out of the U.S. Army, and Breen had always managed to rile citizens because of his occupation. A newspaper editor had labeled the three jackals. Of course, that newspaper editor was now dead and buried, but the name stuck. Breen informed Keegan that the Hardwick brothers had escaped from prison, and the warden and state had posted a $200 reward for their capture and return.
"Huntsville," Keegan had reminded Breen, "is a long way to go for $200.
"Not Huntsville," Breen had said. "The Peering Farm."
Keegan wasn't quite drunk.
"Peering Farm is not what I'd call close."
The farm was a cotton plantation, about as far into the Texas panhandle as white settlers would dare go, even though most Comanches were now pinned up on the reservation near Fort Still in Indian Territory.
"My guess is that the Hardwicks will ride south, Mexico."
That made sense, at least it did at the time, so Keegan had asked,
"What's the split?"
50-50.
$100 could keep a man drunk for a whale of a good time. Now, with Keegan being shot at and sober, he began thinking about why he was here.
"What made you think those outlaws would try for Mexico?" he asked.
"Just a hunch."
Indian Territory's a hell of a lot closer.
Indian Territory's still in the United States.
But, Keegan wiped his mouth, it ain't like ye, being a bounty hunter. Got to get a warrant or a writ or whatever to haul 2 owl hoots back to Texas.
Now Breen moved. He lowered the rifle from his shoulder. He had to be stiff from keeping it aimed all this time, sat up, brought the big rifle beside him, and stared across the hard canyon rim at his partner.
"What the hell do you care? We found them, didn't we?"
Keegan sniffed.
"One of them, maybe."
Breen rubbed the beard stubble on his chin.
"One of them."
His whisper almost escaped Keegan's ears.
"What are you getting at, laddie?"
Keegan asked.
"Only one is shooting at us," Breen said.
Keegan ejected the brass casing from his Springfield, thumbed a .45-70 shell out of the bandolier that hung across his chest, and set that round into the chamber.
"You said Billy Ray's the best with a long gun of them two."
"Better," Breen whispered. "Not best."
"Huh?"
"Ramona's been working on me to talk like the educated man I am."
"Huh."
Keegan brought the carbine closer. Ramona would be Ramona Bonderhoff, daughter of Purgatory City's noted gunsmith. Keegan tried to picture Ramona and Breen together, found the image disgusting, and spit, though there wasn't much to spit out of his parched mouth.
"One rifle, one man, one dugout. 2 horses in the corral."
Breen talked as though he wanted to just hear the thoughts aloud.
"Like he said, he's not the best shot," Keegan said. "And those boys just escaped from a prison farm up at the southern edge of the Panhandle. Maybe they don't got but 1 rifle. Maybe they..."
"Maybes," Breen interrupted, "get a lot of men killed in this country."
Keegan realized that Jed Breen was educated in many ways. So was Sean Keegan.
"Man trapped in a dugout wouldn't be wasting his powder and lead."
Now Keegan started testing theories aloud himself. He had never tried that, but then he had always been the man of action, not the planning type. Jump into the fire and see what happens. He would not question how hot the fire might be or how much Irish whiskey had consumed before making the jump.
He'd know. Good of a shot as he is, the chance of hitting one of us would be slim.
He pulled off his hat and sneaked a quick peek at the dugout. One of the horses in the corral was saddled, the other not. He wished he had thought to bring a spyglass with him. Breen had one, but it was hanging on the horn of his saddle, and they had left their horses at the top of the ridge, climbed down, and found themselves here. When the first shot from the dugout sent Keegan to this spot and Breen to the other, both men figured they had been seen. Just a chance thing, bad luck on their part. But the man with the rifle had scooted back into the dugout, and the standoff began.
"He didn't yell for his brother."
Breen started talking now and looked up the canyon wall, where they had left their horses.
"And he didn't try for the corral," Keegan said. "Where one of those horses is saddled. Brush is thick down there. Some mighty big boulders, too. We both have single shots. Good rider could have gotten away on a saddled horse."
Breen peeked cautiously down the slope, came back to his position, and looked back at Keegan.
"Just 1 horse saddled," he said.
"Aye, laddie, aye."
Now both were staring at the canyon.
"Those horses might be played out," Breen said.
"Aye, they probably are," Keegan said, "if they didn't steal any riding south."
"Not much chance to steal anything between Purgatory City and the Peering Farm," Breen pointed out.
"Except ours." The thought hit Keegan like one of Paddy Fitzsimmons' haymakers back in those glorious days of the Rebellion, when the Irish boys would put on prize-fighting exhibitions for those not blessed to have been born in paradise. They heard the hoofbeats then. Both men sprang to their feet, brought their weapons up, pulled back the hammers, and saw one man, Jim Bob Hardwick, riding Breen's dun, pulling Keegan's sorrel behind him, and aimed. Then ducked, falling flat on their faces, when Billy Ray Hardwick stepped out of the dugout and began sending 38-40 slugs as quick as Paddy Fitzsimmons' punches in the ring. One slug tore at the yellow silk kerchief around his neck. Another punched off Breen's high-crowned black hat. Both men fell to the ground, letting out their vilest curses about their own stupidity. Chapter 2. Blithering idiot. Jed Breen spit dirt out his mouth, cursed and cursed again when he saw the hole through his brand-new hat, which had cost him $2.37 at Pendergrass's Mercantile in Purgatory City. Felt blood on his lips from the tough sand. He had bitten his tongue to boot. Everything had looked so perfect, made to order. They had seen the smoke rising into the colorless sky late that morning, coming out of Fool Fassbinder's folly. That's the name someone 30 years or so earlier had given this canyon. After the German settler Fassbinder, the first name had long been forgotten, had settled in the canyon. No one knew or remembered his reason. There was no gold, no silver, nothing but granite and prickly pear, a few hardwoods and a lot of hardships. But his dugout would always be a welcoming spot for travelers in this harsh country. Fassbinder, though, never knew about it, for the hostile Comanches, some say Kiowas, killed him shortly after he built his first fire. Or so the legend went. But Breen and Keegan knew of the canyon, and the smoke meant someone might be visiting. They wanted to make sure the fool at the Dead Fool's dugout wasn't the Hardwick boys, so they found the goat trail that led up the canyon, left their horses in a shady spot with some grain and good, secure hobbles, and climbed down to the flat spot, found the cabin, and almost caught a bullet. Now, however, Breen could picture in his mind exactly what had happened. Jim Bob Hardwick, always considered the better cowboy, had left his older brother in the dugout, ridden to the canyon's exit, and waited. When he spotted two men riding toward him, he mounted his horse, galloped back to the corral, told his brother, and then he ran, afoot, to the canyon's exit. Billy Ray started a fire, got the chimney puffing out smoke like a locomotive pulling a freight train up a steep mountain grade on a cold December morning. And while Keegan and Breen, two greedy sons of guns acting like two greenhorns, climbed down to get the drop on the outlaws, Jim Bob found their horses and stole them. While Billy Ray, a fine shot with a puny little Winchester toy gun, kept Keegan and Breen pinned down with nothing much to do but pontificate. That would give Jim Bob time enough to find the horses, ride down the slope, come back to the canyon's entrance, gallop back to the dugout to save his brother, and ride away, free to push on to the Rio Grande, swim that creek of a river this time of year, and live happily ever after in Mexico. And it wasn't like those boys were leaving two idiots to join Fool Fassbinder buried in this lonely canyon. The Hardwick boys weren't even leaving them afoot. They had two horses in the corral, which might or might not be lame. They even had a fire going, though it had to be 91 degrees right about now. They might be able to nurse their way back to Purgatory City, or maybe even up to Peering Farm, which made Jed Breen madder than a rattlesnake. The Hardwick boys were raising dust for the border on Breen's and Keegan's horses. $200 getting away on mounts Breen and Keegan had paid good money for. Well, Jed Breen knew he had paid $30 for his. Keegan might have won his in a boxing match, or found it and claimed it for his own. $200 did not amount to much. Jed Breen had brought in men worth far heftier rewards. But it was the principle that mattered. He dropped to his knee and brought the sharps up tight against his shoulder. "What the hell are you doing?" Keegan shouted. "You might hit one of the horses and not those English-loving dogs." "So?" "Them's our horses." "No,
Breen said calmly. He made the adjustments in his head, shooting at a galloping target, shooting downhill, factoring in the wind, always...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?